Are you the Quantum Mechanics?
Yes, we are the Quantum Mechanics, the paranormal podcast for the believers, the doubters, and everybody in between.
Had some good reaction from the episode we did last week, didn't we? Especially on Patreon. There was a lot of activity there on that one.
Yeah, we did, actually, yes. About being eaten.
Yes, eaten by aliens.
Eaten by aliens, yes. Chakra Magnet pointing out what would happen if we were, you know, how would we become tastier?
Yeah, I started thinking, you know, because McDonald's have got that thing called they call it the bliss point, don't they?
Oh, yes, you were telling me about this, with sugar and salt and everything
together. They get that, the combination just right that makes you really want it and crave it. And I did start thinking after seeing Chakra Magnet's post that could there be some kind of fast food conspiracy to make us taste better for the aliens?
I mean, maybe. Yesterday, I ate a lot of garlic, I swear. If anyone tries eating me, they're going to be, they won't want to be kissing anybody after that.
Yeah, excellent.
But yeah, join in. Thank you as well. Jacqueline Bell just joined us. Come and join us at Patreon, patreon.com/TQMpod.
Cool. I've also got another update on the episode we did on paranormal pooches.
Oh, yes.
Luke, who's a friend of the show, who's also a zoologist, sent me a message saying that, you know, we were talking about the third eyelid that dogs have, the one that yours had a bit of trouble with.
Yes, the bada bada bing or whatever it's called.
Yeah, the one what is it called? Vestigial, is that it? Vestigial?
Yes.
And it's there to help dogs when they're going through, like, high-level bush or grass that they don't get scratched in the eye. Well, he says, apparently we've got one of those as well.
Do we?
Yes. Luke says we have a vestigial one in the corner of our eye. I don't think it does what the dog one does. So we have a third eyelid, but I don't think it covers the whole eye. But there is a bit of a remnant of one in the corner of our eye.
Oh, right. Okay. Yeah, I suppose vestigial means that it's not really used anymore. Because the actual name of the dog one, it was that bing, bing, bing. What did you call it? A ting-tang. Oh. Nick-titter-ting. I don't know how else you would say it.
Yeah.
Nick-titter-ting.
Yeah. Is that the one that the third eyelid, or is that something else?
No, that's the third eyelid, the nick-titter-ting.
Right. The nick-titter-ting. Well, apparently we've got a little one of those, but I don't think it does what a dog's one does.
No. Oh, well.
Now, when he said this, I thought I would push my luck having a zoologist in contact. So I asked Luke if he had any explanation that was more scientific for the glowing dog.
Oh, good shout, yes.
And he says the hair of his coat could be like a polar bear's, which has no pigment and is glass-like, so reflecting the colour of its habitat, i.e. firelight.
Oh, I see what you mean. So it's almost it's like those, you get those Christmas tree things for your desk and you put a battery at the bottom.
Yeah.
Optical fibre, that's what we're looking for.
It's
yes.
It's a bit like that. So there's something about the pigment of certain animals that makes them glass-like, so they can reflect light. I guess it's a defence mechanism in some ways, almost camouflage maybe.
Yeah, maybe maybe if that dog had seen things from you were projecting something in the right direction, you could actually project a habitat onto it so it would become invisible. There's a thing.
Yeah, so glowing dogs could be a kind of natural thing. Interesting.
It's the way forward.
I'm loving Luke as our zoological advisor.
It's good that we're picking up some proper advisors. I feel like we need it.
Yeah, definitely. Definitely.
I tell you what we need is a linguist.
We do need a linguist. And we probably need a musician for today's episode.
Oh, right. Where's that?
Well, this episode came about because I've had an earworm all week. Give you the background. I was listening to the new album by Future Islands, or the current one. I think it was out in January. And I started thinking, oh, there was this old song they used to do called Seasons, which I quite liked. So I had a couple of listens of that and watched a couple of YouTube videos. This band, Future Islands, their lead singer is quite an interesting performer. You watch him and you can't work out whether he's incredibly cool or looks like a kind of drunk dad at a wedding. So, yeah, worth checking them out, Future Islands. Have a look at his performance. You'll know what I mean. But their old song, Seasons, just got into my head like an earworm. I was going to bed and I was humming it, sometimes singing it out loud, sometimes in my head. I'd wake up in the morning, it'd be there. And this went on for days. And I started to think, we've done episodes on spells and how words can seemingly have a paranormal effect on people. And I wondered if the same could be said of music and songs.
Okay.
So can a song literally be haunted rather than just haunting?
Oh, I see. Actually bring with it some kind of like entity attachment or...
some paranormal power. Are some songs cursed?
I see.
Now, it turns out there's quite a lot of examples where that might be the case. I was quite surprised when I did my research. So I'm not going to go into backmasking. We did that, like subliminal messages in music, you know, stuff played backwards. We covered that on an old episode we did called Satan is a DJ. And we did a bonus episode where we played that episode backwards, which upset a lot of people.
Everyone loved that episode.
Yeah, he's being ironic. I'm not going to do any of that. This is about the song and the music itself, and could it be cursed?
Okay.
Before we get into some examples of songs that some people believed are cursed, let's first take a look at what powerful effect music can have on us. Now, surprisingly, there's been a great deal of scientific research on the power of music. Let's explore some of the boffins' findings, shall we?
The boffins!
Listening to music triggers the release of three powerful chemicals. The first one is dopamine, which I think many of us will know. It stimulates an area of the brain that gives us feelings of pleasure, satisfaction, and motivation. Serotonin is also triggered by music, often described as a mood regulator. It can help regulate anxiety, create feelings of happiness, and it's even got the power as a chemical to physically heal wounds.
Nice.
Music also stimulates oxytocin. Now, this chemical has a big connection with labour and childbirth, but outside of that, it can cause sexual arousal, create feelings of trust, and aid romantic attachments. It's the chemical equivalent of listening to Marvin Gaye, I reckon. Purely from a chemical perspective, music has a strong effect on our emotions and behaviour, but I was also thinking it kind of affects us in other ways as well. I was thinking of kind of rave days, Ben. We were both there, right? I think
very
we
much.
There. So music connects us with friends, even strangers, in rave culture terms. And that is likely to have developed over 1,000 years as a kind of tribal bonding exercise. So bonding the tribe together. The oldest discovered musical instrument could be over 300,000 years old. It's incredible, that, isn't it?
Yeah, what is it, bagpipes?
No, it's a type of bone flute.
Oh, I've got a bone flute.
I'm not going to ask any follow-up questions. Music can also help us process and get in touch with our emotions. Not only does the music trigger past memories and feelings, it can also give us a space to engage our subconscious. I guess it's a bit like dreaming, in a way, listening to music. You know, you often get that feeling when you're listening to
music.
Very
much so, yeah.
So in that sense, it helps us organise and process our thoughts and emotions. We've talked before about the military have used music in warfare, whether that's the US military playing Metallica or AC/DC through large speakers on top of their Hummers in Iraq.
Mm-hmm.
Even the British Merchant Navy tried to ward off Somali pirates by playing Britney Spears' Hit Me Baby One More Time.
That would have worked for me. That really would.
You'd have avoided your pirating.
Oh, definitely, definitely.
Well, basically, Ben, music is powerful stuff, right? But I wondered, has anybody created a piece of music that is so powerful that it is cursed? Either through some kind of paranormal process, like you said, an entity attaching to it or whatever, or because of the strength of the emotions it induces in the listener.
And what did you find?
Well, the answer seems to be yes.
Mm.
Should we have a look at some of them?
Yeah.
Let's start with one of the biggest songs ever written, My Way. Made famous by Frank Sinatra, but also recorded by Elvis Presley, Sid Vicious. Many, many people have recorded My Way, right?
Yes. It's like a... pretty much everyone knows what that song is.
Yeah. Now, some might say the song is cursed because some of the people who recorded it you know, died quite soon after. So Elvis Presley died shortly after recording his version. Sid Vicious also died less than a year after he recorded the song. But the real curse seems to relate to the Philippines, a country where in many karaoke bars, one of the most popular karaoke classics of all time is banned.
Why is it banned?
It's called The Curse of My Way, and it goes back to 1998 and what became known as the My Way Killings.
The My Way Killings.
So after performing My Way, or sometimes during the song itself, a number of people were murdered at karaoke bars, basically because of their terrible rendition of this classic tune.
Well, I've heard of murdering a song, but...
Yeah, it's murder on the dance floor, murder on the karaoke floor.
Goodness.
Now, one of the most high-profile killings took place in a bar in San Mateo in Risa in 2007. A 29-year-old man was halfway through the song when a security guard told him to stop because he was singing it out of tune. The man refused and continued his crooning. So the security guard pulled out his gun and shot him in the chest, killing him instantly.
Okay, there's no need for that.
That is taking it too far, isn't it?
I presume that he went to... I mean, yes, of course he went to jail.
Yes, he was convicted of murder. So there were My Way killings before then. That one got a lot of profile, I guess because it was mid-song. Now, in 2018, at a birthday party, one man tried to sing his interpretation of My Way, and a fight broke out as one of the guests tried to stop him. The singer was stabbed in the chest, died later at the Zamboanga del Nor Medical Centre. It is estimated, Ben, that as many as 12 people have been killed performing the song in the Philippines.
I can't get my head around this. What, because it makes people so crazy that they get it wrong?
Yeah, that it's sung so badly seems to be the theme. That's just the people who died. 12 at least who died, and countless others who suffered injuries while being stopped from doing it their way, I guess.
Right, okay.
One regular karaoke fan told the New York Times in 2010, "I used to like My Way, but after all the trouble, I stopped singing it. You can get killed. The trouble with My Way..."
That's nuts.
"The trouble with My Way is that everyone knows it, and everyone has an opinion."
Yeah, I mean, that's the trouble with it. The trouble with it is people are getting stupidly mad over somebody. I mean, I just don't know what to say.
I wonder, because it's weird, because you would think there would be examples of it outside the Philippines, but for some reason in the Philippines it's taken on this power. I wonder, you know, I guess that could come down to some kind of mass hysteria in a way, that once stories start circulating of you can get killed at a karaoke bar singing My Way, does it just then almost become a self-fulfilling prophecy?
Yeah, maybe? It becomes like, I won't do that just in case. I can understand that.
Well, let's move on. Have you ever heard of a band called Badfinger?
No, I don't think so.
It's not surprising because many people haven't. However, in the 1970s, this Welsh band were tipped to be the biggest thing since the Beatles.
Okay.
That was until two members of the band decided to merge two of their songs together. Peter Ham and Tom Evans had both written two deeply emotional tunes about their respective relationship breakups. The band decided to put these two songs together in one despair-laden track called Without You. If you've not heard of the band, I'm pretty sure most of you out there will know the song, with its chorus that pulls at your heartstrings with the lyrics, "I can't live if living is without you."
I know that. Yes, I know that.
That was really badly sung, but I thought it was the only way to be sure. Yeah, okay, thank you. Many believe that the act of merging the two original songs created one track so full of emotion and sadness, it cursed the band and the song itself. One of the reasons the band were tipped to become the next Beatles was it was the Beatles themselves who had signed them to their label, Apple Records.
Oh, interesting.
Global domination looked almost guaranteed, right? You've just been signed by the Beatles, you're on their record label. Now, they did have some early success, including a track written and produced by Paul McCartney and others produced by George Harrison. However, after Badfinger recorded Without You, everything began to crumble. The Beatles went through their own messy breakup, and their Apple record label was also in disarray, with Badfinger eventually being cut adrift, I guess dropped off the label. Not because of anything they'd done, not because they weren't doing well, just Apple, the Beatles, were in a bit of a mess at the time. Badfinger then signed with a new manager called Stan Poley. How would we describe Poley's management? I think Poley's management can better be described as mismanagement, possibly fraudulent. So their association with their new manager left the band almost penniless, despite having some previously successful songs and albums. Now, Without You went on to be a different kind of curse for the two men who wrote it, when rock legend Harry Nilsson heard the track at a friend's house and decided to do a cover version. Released in 1971, Nilsson's version of the track became one of his biggest hits. It's probably the version that most of us are familiar with. When you think of that song, it's probably the Harry Nilsson version that is in your mind. But however, due to Badfinger's poor management and the dubious contracts their manager had put in place, the two original songwriters saw little or none of the money from the success.
I hate it when that happens. It's so sad.
Can you imagine? Because it was such a huge song, wasn't it, in the 70s. I would have thought you're driving in your car, wherever you're travelling, you're probably hearing it on the radio, seeing
this
guy.
I've seen it on adverts.
Yeah, on adverts, seeing this guy singing it on TV, and you know you're not going to get a penny from it.
I wonder if they're still with us.
Well, let's get on to that. Now, the band did soldier on. However, the stresses and strains, especially the financial ones, took their toll, with the two band members who wrote Without You ending up taking their own lives.
Oh, no.
Peter Ham passing away on April the 24th, 1975, aged 27. And Tom Evans committing suicide 8 years later in 1983.
Tragic.
Now, many connect Badfinger's sad demise with the writing of Without You, that somehow, by merging these two deeply emotional, sad songs together, they made one cursed song. But the curse of the song didn't end with Badfinger and the songwriters. In 1994, Mariah Carey recorded a cover version of Without You. Just days before its release, Harry Nilsson, who had made the song famous, died of a sudden heart attack, age 52.
Wow, I can understand where the idea of a curse comes from then.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. I should say, by the way, we are going to put a Spotify playlist of all the songs we talk about today.
Oh, lovely.
So we'll drop a link to that in our Patreon site, so patreon.com/TQMpod. So you can go and hear some of these songs, or just Google them, obviously, but we'll put them into one playlist. It's that idea, when you do listen to that. So I remember listening to that song as a kid. I'd just broken up with my girlfriend. I was a little, you know, teenager, first girlfriend. We'd broken up. Listening to that song, you know, it does pull at your heartstrings, and it does make you think, did they put so much emotion into it that, not necessarily from a paranormal side, but something about it did make the song cursed in some way. Now, before we have some stories, more stories, Ben, I thought it wouldn't be an episode about music without a chart countdown.
Go, Bruno.
So let's start with a rundown of the 10 saddest songs of all time. Now, these are not picked by music journalists. They're not picked on the number of plays or sales, but through scientific research.
Ah, is there an algorithm?
There's an algorithm. It was compiled from a scientific research study conducted by Dr. Harry Witchell, who is an expert in sociology and music. He used measurements of people's reaction to music, including heart rate, respiratory responses, skin temperature, to find out what he calls a song, I love this, tune trigger quotient. From his research, the top saddest songs of all time are, now I must say, I think this research was done in the UK rather than America. So if you're listening in America and you're going, what? You know, this is scientific research in the UK, so it is a bit UK-centric. At number 10, we have Radiohead, Fake Plastic Trees.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, you had to have a Radiohead in there, didn't you?
used to great effect in that Father Ted episode.
Yeah.
If you don't know what, if you've never seen Father Ted, it's just, it's used to signify, it's sort of like the stereotypical Radiohead. A man is very happy, gets on a bus, hears Radiohead, right. Becomes very unhappy.
Yeah, well, fake plastic trees will do that to you. At number nine, we have James Blunt with Goodbye, My Lover.
I'm very unhappy on James Blunt, but anyway, yes.
Yeah, although I do love his Twitter feed. It's very, very funny, if you've ever seen his Twitter feed.
He is, yes, I'll give you that.
At number eight, Christina Aguilera, Beautiful. It's quite inspiring, Beautiful, in a way, though, isn't it? I'm surprised it's in the top ten.
Yeah, I'm surprised, actually. I never thought of it as a sad song, really.
At number seven, we have Elvis Presley, Are You Lonesome Tonight?
Oh, yeah, classic.
Yeah, I mean, that's got to, hasn't it? At number six, Will Young, Leave Right Now. That might say something about the time the research was done.
I was going to say, yeah.
At number five, I think this would probably make a sad song in terms of sales and music journalists as well. But from scientific research, the number five saddest song is Sinead O'Connor's Nothing Compares to You.
Yeah, I thought that would be in there, yeah.
I don't think it... Yeah, I think that's probably helped by that emotional video where Sinead sheds real tears. Sad loss, Sinead.
Mm.
Another sad loss. At number four, Whitney Houston, I Will Always Love You.
Mm-hmm.
At number three, I kind of agree with this one as one of Elton John's saddest songs. Sorry seems to be the hardest word.
Yeah, that's a good song, yeah.
At number two, Robbie Williams' Angels.
Oh.
Yeah, I don't like that song, I must say. Now, and the chart topper for the saddest song of all time, according to scientific research. It's a great song, but I was surprised it was at number one. It's The Verve with The Drugs Don't Work.
Oh, no. I hate that song.
Do you not
too.
Like that song?
No, I don't. I think it's mawkish, but...
What's surprising about that song, I think... Most people think about it as being about drugs, but I believe it's about the death of the singer's father.
Yes, I believe so, yeah.
Yeah, so I guess that's got that connection too. But yeah, according to scientific research, The Verve, The Drugs Don't Work, is the saddest song ever made.
I think they were missing one in there.
Go on. Well, let's do that. What would your choice be of the saddest song?
My saddest song, Love Will Tear Us Apart.
Joy Division.
Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. Good. That's good because it's also up. It's kind of upbeat, but it has got that sadness to it.
Yeah. I think sadness, it's haunting.
Sadness with the connection of Ian Curtis killing
Correct.
Himself.
Absolutely. Or, yeah, yes. Okay. Yes. Absolutely. That song is, I don't know, it's just so clever. As soon as you hear it, it's brooding and passionate, and you know exactly what mood it is. You can't dance to it.
Yeah, that's true. Well, I think I would go with Johnny Cash's version of the Nine Inch Nails song Hurt. That always got me, and especially because after his death you watch the video and it's really, I remember watching it being quite moved. I'm a big Johnny Cash fan anyway, but yeah, that's a great song, but very sad.
Yeah, that's a good choice actually.
Now, something we've discussed on the podcast many times when we've talked about curses is that maybe it's someone's belief in the curse that can take hold rather than the curse itself. It's a theme we've toyed with, let's say. But this next story maybe stretches that theory and could be the actual words and the song itself has some kind of paranormal power. It involves the curse of a song called Incha Jai Atho. I hope I've said that right. Which translates from Hindi to English as Get Up Incha. I've heard it. I wondered if it was almost kind of a come on Eileen, but it's not. It's really not. But yes, Get Up Incha is the translation. Became the biggest hit for a Pakistani singer, Aminat Al Khan. The lyrics were taken from a poem written by Ibn Isha in the 1970s. Now, Amit Ali Khan was such a fan of the poem and its dark lyrical take on urban life that he approached the poet and asked if he could turn his words into a song. Khan first performed the song on television in 1974 and the tune became an instant hit. However, a few months after he first performed it, Aminat Ali Khan, with the song riding high in the charts, died suddenly from appendicitis, age 52.
No. Oh.
This started the rumours that the song and its lyrics were cursed, and reports of other deaths connected to it followed. Perhaps feeling guilty for the cursed prose he had created, the poet who penned the original lyrics wrote a letter to a friend saying, "How many more lives will this cursed poem take?" The very next day, after writing those words to his friend, the poet died of cancer. It was exactly 4 years after the original release of the song.
That's spooky.
And to the poet's question, how many more lives will this cursed poem take? The answer was at least three more. Ahmed Khan, the son of the original singer, died after singing the song at a festival. This was followed by the untimely death of the song's producer, Khalil Ahmed. This is just tragic. Then another of Khan's sons died, age 52, the same age as his father, after singing the song at a 2006 concert in honour of his father. It was the last song he ever sung.
Maybe it was foolhardy to... Oh, well, I don't know.
To do it.
Yeah.
Yeah. But it's interesting, isn't it? There's something... I wonder if that one's more about the words, maybe, than the music. That, you know, the poem had obviously haunted the guy who originally recorded the song. And he really wanted to do it. And then from that moment on, but it felt as if the poet himself was fearful that he'd created something cursed in his words, yeah. Which is fascinating.
It's almost you're turning it not quite into a tulpa, but you're giving it its own agency in a way.
Yeah, its own power, maybe. Mm. Yeah, no, I was thinking that. Now, we've looked at a number of stories involving cursed songs, but it would be amiss, Ben, of us not to look at perhaps the greatest paranormal tale in rock and roll history. A blues artist who is said to have sold his soul to the devil.
Oh, yeah.
For talent and fame.
Yes, yes. Yeah, years ago, working on a London jazz station, used to play quite a lot of him.
Yeah, we're talking about the iconic blues man, Robert Johnson. Now, during his lifetime, he only had one hit record, Teleplane Blues, which sold 5,000 copies. He only recorded 29 songs and died in 1938, aged 27. 27 again. That's two in this episode, and then we've got the 27 Club. It's weird,
yeah,
isn't it?
It is weird, yeah.
Now, Johnson's life was cut short after he was poisoned by a club owner in retaliation for Johnson sleeping with his wife.
Oh, I didn't know that part of the story.
Yeah. Now, in death, Robert Johnson has become an iconic legend, rightly because of his music genius. Keith Richards once said of Johnson, "If you want to know how good the blues can get, well, this is it." That's pretty good praise, isn't it?
It is, yeah.
But there is another story that has helped build the legend of Robert Johnson, that he sold his soul to the devil. So the story goes that Robert Johnson was just this lazy womanizer who couldn't get a decent tune out of his guitar. Until one night at the crossroads of Route 49 and 61, he made a deal with the devil. In exchange for his soul, Johnson was given the ability to play great blues, which he did until his death 3 years later in 1938. Johnson went on to gain critical success, and post his death has sold close to 2 million copies of his box set, The Complete Recordings, and it includes the track Crossroad Blues, which is about that devilish encounter.
Mm.
Now, Robert Johnson himself once described his encounter with Satan, telling a fellow blues musician, Son House, that, I quote, "He met a dark man at a crossroads who had tuned his guitar for him." What a great phrase.
He wasn't shy about talking about what had happened, though, was
no,
he?
No, and that kind of phrase about the devil tuning your guitar, I think that's become a bit of a rock and roll
thing. It really has, yes. Yes, well, our slogan for our blues show was playing the devil's music to London.
Right, okay, that's interesting. But did Robert Johnson really encounter the devil and sell his soul, or is it just the perfect rock and roll myth?
I think it's a great story that he put around.
Well, Robert Johnson's grandson, Stephen Johnson, is sceptical. Stephen is a preacher and musician who plays both gospel and blues. When he spoke with Don Wilcott of American Blues Scene, he told him it was a myth. Robert Johnson's grandson told the magazine, "I often tell people to listen to the lyrics of Crossroad Blues. Why would you go to the crossroads to sell your soul to the devil and be asking God to save you at the same time? Another blues artist, who's also a minister, Rory Block, points out the meanings of the lyrics in Crossroad Blues. He says, listen to the words. I went down to the crossroads. I fell down on my knees. I asked the Lord for mercy. He said, poor Bob, if you please. Block says it's obvious the man was preaching, adding, I never involved myself in the idea of blues being the music of the devil. It might be a cool thing to say, to write a story about, or as Johnson's grandson said, it makes a great movie, but it didn't happen.
Yeah.
I guess a believer in the story and the myth would say, well, these two very religious men would say that, wouldn't they?
Of course.
They would say the encounter never happened, you know, because of their religious calling. But the curse of the song, Crossroad Blues, sometimes referred to as the Crossroad Curse, didn't end with Robert Johnson. I didn't know this next bit, but both Robert Plant and Eric Clapton tragically lost sons after covering the song. I knew they lost sons, but I didn't know it was after they covered it.
I didn't know it was after they covered that, no.
Lynyrd Skynyrd and members of the Allman Brothers also died after performing it. Lynyrd Skynyrd famously in a plane crash.
Mm.
And here's another one. It's also rumoured that Kurt Cobain was considering doing a cover version of the song just before he took his own life in 1994.
Goodness.
Aged wow. 27.
27 again, yes.
It's an amazing, like you said, it's a lovely myth and legend, and you can see why during his lifetime and posthumously people have kept it going, because it is just one of the greatest rock and roll stories. And this vision that this guy who couldn't really play chips up the devil gives him this talent. Amazing.
It's even been used in The Simpsons and Family Guy.
And numerous artists have referred to it. There's a Nick Cave and the Bad Seeds songs called Higgs Boson Blues, where Nick Cave talks about Robert Johnson and the devil, and he says, I don't know who's going to rip off who, which I think is a great lyric.
That is good.
I started to wonder at this point, Ben, whether this concept of cursed music was somehow connected to a type of satanic or moral panic, maybe because of, you know, these religious people saying, you know, blues is not the devil's music, all that stuff. And we've seen some of this moral panic in the history of rock and roll, right the way through. When Bill Haley and the Comets came along, it was thought that rock and roll, you know, was going to destroy America. Same with Elvis Presley to a degree. We've seen it with blues, with Robert Johnson, R&B, hip-hop, and pop music as well. And that quote about the blues being seen as the devil music, or that parental panic when Bill Haley or Elvis arrived on the scene, it's carried on with some of the stories we've done on heavy metal, right? The satanic panic about backmasking and all that stuff, and religious panic.
Yes.
So I thought, well, maybe this is all about that. But this connection with cursed music and paranormal influences goes back much earlier than that. And it's actually quite rife in classical music, which I didn't know. And this is illustrated by not one piece of music, but several. Now, a bit like the infamous 27 Club, which we've been referencing, you know, the list of artists who died aged 27, this one focuses on the number 9 and relates to the 9th symphony written by multiple classical composers. It is known as the Curse of the 9th.
I'd never heard of this.
Beethoven, Franz Schubert, Vaughan Williams and Antonin Dvorak all died after completing their 9th symphonies. The curse carried so much weight that the classical composer Gustav Mahler tried to trick the curse by not referring to his 9th symphony as a symphony.
Did it work?
It didn't work.
Oh.
While composing what technically would have been his 10th symphony, he was struck down with pneumonia and died before completing it. So whichever way you look at it, he died after writing his 9th, which he claimed wasn't his 9th, but either way, he died during the writing of his 10th, which could have been his 9th. That was a really complicated way. Yes, it didn't work for him. Modern classical composer Philip Glass came up with a better solution than Mahler, deciding to write his 9th and 10th symphonies at the same time.
Oh, clever.
And that proved successful.
That's the way to cheat it.
There. Now, from a sceptical view, there are a couple of things to consider here. I was thinking, I guess for most composers, you need to have had somewhat of an illustrious career and be of a certain age to actually get to the point where you get to write a Ninth Symphony, right? So your odds of dying do go up the more symphonies you write, basically.
Oh, yeah, of course, yeah.
So how many symphonies can one write in a lifetime? I guess, again, Mozart managed to write 41 symphonies, so he wasn't suffered by the curse of the ninth, and obviously many composers haven't, but it has become a thing in classical music.
Right, okay. I will remember that.
Yeah,
when I'm writing my
what are you
first.
You're on your seventh now, aren't you? Now, we talked about Robert Johnson a minute ago and his meeting with the devil at a crossroads. Well, he was not the first musician to say he sold his soul to the devil. This may well have been the classical composer Giuseppe Tartini.
I do know something of this story.
Okay. So this is Tartini claimed that the devil visited him in a dream in 1713. The devil asked Tartini to teach him how to play the violin. Tartini gave Satan a display of his talents and some tips on how to play, then handed his violin to the devil to see what he could do. Tartini himself described the dream to a friend. He said, "One night I dreamt I had a pact with the devil for my soul. Everything went as I wished. My new servant anticipated my every desire. Among other things, I gave him my violin to see if he could play. How great my astonishment on hearing a sonata so beautiful, played with such great art and intelligence as I'd ever conceived in my boldest flights of fantasy. I felt enraptured, transported, my breath failed me, and I awoke." Tartini, it's a bit like when I did that the Sherlock violin. I felt the same when you listen back to that.
My breath failed me too.
For different reasons. So Tartini said that in the dream, Satan stood in front of him playing a violin. He described Satan's playing as technically and musically astonishing. When the composer awoke, he tried to transcribe the music exactly as the devil had played it. The piece he created went on to be one of his most successful, but I guess it came with its own curse for the composer. Tartini was never satisfied that he fully reflected the beauty of the music he heard in the dream. So it frustrated him for the rest of his life.
Yeah, that was the bit I remembered from the story, yes.
Tartini's composition is known as the Devil's Trill. It's made up of four parts and is one of classical music's most technical and difficult to play pieces. Which I guess all adds to the legend, doesn't it?
It does. It makes it more alluring as a piece to not only learn but listen to.
Yeah, definitely.
The supernatural origin always makes things more enticing.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah. On the classical front then, we've had the Curse of the Ninth, so writing your Ninth Symphony will probably lead to your death. We've had this example of the composer who sold his soul to the devil but couldn't quite reproduce what he'd heard. The last one I've got in the classical world is the famous composer Robert Schumann. He was a pianist as well as a composer, and he was born in 1810. Now, he claimed that one of his compositions was influenced and guided by multiple visits by spirits and entities during its composition. Schumann said that during the writing, he was visited by both angelic and evil spirits, some of them even threatening to send him to hell.
It's a bit harsh.
Yeah. The process of writing the music and these visitations took its toll on Schumann. At one point, he tried to commit suicide, and he ordered his wife to leave him as he was afraid he would do her harm. So this was playing with his mind. So he's there trying to compose this piece of music. He's got these angelic spirits and demonic spirits that he said were visiting constantly. After he finished the piece, I'm going to do some bad pronunciation here, called Geistervariationen. I guess that's German. Geistervariationen, maybe? Ghost variations to me and you, Ben.
Right, right.
Schumann was admitted to a psychiatric institute, and it was the last piece of music he wrote.
Well, I'm not saying they're connected, but they're probably connected.
Yeah, they might be connected. Yeah.
I think they might be connected, yes.
Yes. Like I said, all these songs we've put on a Spotify playlist. So if you go to patreon.com /TQM pod. You can pick up a link for those and have a listen to some of these tracks. Well, Ben, there's been a lot of sadness and loss on the podcast this week, right?
It has.
So I thought I'd end with another top 10 chart rundown. Try and liven things up a bit. This time, the happiest songs of all time.
Is it Shiny Happy People by R.E.M.?
No. Again, this chart was not compiled by music critics, record sales or streams. It was another scientific study put together by music psychologist Dr. Michael Bonshaw from the University of Sheffield. I don't know why I'm going to say this, but it did say it in the research I did. The study was commissioned by yogurt brand Müller Lite.
Oh, come on.
I don't think it matters. But
we've had a lot of academic studies.
But not one brought to you. Not one brought to you by Müller Lite.
Unbelievable.
The study, Dr. Bonshaw found the most uplifting songs have a tempo of 137 beats per minute. They are bright and bouncy notes and have a beat that we can dance to, whether we dance to it or not. But those are the kind of... So if you're looking to write a happy song, bear that in mind. 137 beats per minute, bright and bouncy notes and a beat you can dance to.
Okay.
So according to their formula, the study concluded the top 10 happiest songs of all time are at number 10. September by Earth, Wind and Fire.
Okay, yes.
I get that. That you can't hear that song without a smile, can you?
No.
At number 9, Waterloo by ABBA.
Yes.
I've got to say, a lot of this list is like going to a bad wedding, just to let you know. At number 8 in the happiest songs of all time, YMCA by the Village People.
Oh, my Lord.
At number 7, I Get Around by the Beach Boys.
You do hear that at every wedding.
Yeah. It's an odd one. Love it as a song, but I think there are better candidates in the collection than this one. At number 6, Sun Is Shining by Bob Marley.
Yeah, I can get that.
I would have gone with Could You Be Loved or something like that.
So yeah, yeah.
I mean, I love Sun Is Shining, but there you go. At number 5. Oh, this was a song when I was like, when it was out, I absolutely hated and drove me nuts. Number 5 is Uptown Girl by Billy Joel.
Oh, yeah.
And number 4, Get the Party Started by Pink.
Yeah.
Number 3 in the happiest songs of all time, House of Fun by Madness.
Madness
had that formula right, didn't they? And number 2, I Got You, I Feel Good by James Brown.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
Just from the opening notes, you're in, aren't you? You're into happiness. And at number 1, a second entry in the top 10 by the Beach Boys. The happiest song of all time, according to scientific research.
And Müller Lite.
And Müller Lite is the Beach Boys' Good Vibrations.
Okay, yeah, I can see where they're coming from.
So again, I'm a massive Beach Boys fan, and I think they're a much misunderstood band. If you want to understand the Beach Boys, go and listen to the Smile Sessions, which are just incredible. Their version of Good Vibrations on there is amazing. It is one of my favourite songs, but I always thought it had a bit of a melancholy vibe to it.
Yeah, I do too.
So like Help Me Rhonda or something like that, that's kind of more upbeat. But no, that's apparently it. I would have gone possibly for Stevie Wonder's Superstition. Does that make me a really good paranormal podcaster? But I love that song. It always makes me feel happy.
Yeah, no, that is good.
What would you go for?
Well, you said come prepared with one, and I didn't know what the context was. Mine's a bit more obscure. Okay. It's Under Pressure by Sunscreen. I think that's the happiest song.
Okay.
That always cheers me up.
Okay. No, that's a good one. I get that vibe. I've got this vision of you on a... dancing on a beach in Ibiza now.
Yeah. Well, it's on my driving in the car. That and anything by the Space Brothers.
Okay, good. Well, all of these songs, like I said, we put together on a playlist. So go to patreon.com, TQM pod, for the links for that. And I've got to say, when I put that playlist together, it's the weirdest playlist I've created in my whole life. Got a bit of blues on there. You've got a bit of music from Afghanistan. You've got all these happy songs, all these sad songs, interspersed with some classical pieces. It is a very strange playlist. So anybody who comes across that playlist on Spotify will not be able to work out what we've done there. But hopefully now you've listened to the podcast, you'll understand its construction.
Fast forward to Madness.
Yeah, exactly.
I should have said to Unlimited, get ready for this, and then it would have been a really eclectic playlist.
Yeah. Well, in conclusion, Ben, I'm left with the feeling that a song can be cursed. And like I said, while I was listening to that Harry Nilsson version of Without You, it really made me see the power of it. I guess the mixture of the sad lyrics, that melody is full of despair. And especially on the Nilsson version of it, the production is like really haunting as well. So you do feel there is some power there. But I guess there's something about knowing the legend of the curse that adds a certain poignance to it. So like I said, with that song, I did hear it when I was a teenager and it did kind of move me, and I was going through, you know, my first relationship breaking up. But knowing that there is this almost sad, cursed story around it does make it even more poignant, I think.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Well, you know, the same story for me with Love Will Tear Us Apart and teenage angst and lost love, that it did the same for me.
A book I'd really recommend on music, not it's got no paranormal connection, but is David Byrne's from Talking Heads book, How Music Works. It's a brilliant book if you love music. It's really worth a read. So I'd check that out if you get a chance.
Excellent choice. Yes, I will. My dad's recommended that to me, actually. I will give that a go.
Yeah, there's so much in there about how you record music, where it's played, how it affects the sound. Like in churches, those kind of notes, because they're delivered in an echoey setting, influences the way they're composed. It's really fascinating.
Right, okay, that makes sense.
Yeah, well, that's it. That's our musical extravaganza for the day.
I was very good, thank you. I will maybe listen to some of those in the drive on the way home, although maybe only the happy ones, not the cursed ones.
Yeah, don't do Without You.
Oh, no.
Yeah.
Well, thank you very much. That was great. So, well, when the time you listen to this, you will be on Easter Monday.
Yes.
So
yes.
I hope you are full of chocolate eggs and good cheer.
Oh, by the way, you know, I mentioned that story about the guy up in Scotland who'd bought the too many Easter eggs.
Yes, yes.
There's been a follow-up to that story because he's put them online to kind of raise money for charity, and he's now shipping them out all over the world. People want his Easter eggs because of the story. So he's been shipping to America, to UK, to the mainland of Scotland. He's had to order more eggs because he's run out.
I mean, that's a wonderful story because it's going to charity. But it just says you need a story behind something for you to want it. Yeah.
Yeah. Cool. Well, enjoy your eggs. Enjoy your Easter bank holiday. And we will see you next week on The Quantum Mechanic.
See you next week. Take care.
Bye.
Bye.
Are you the quantum mechanics?